Hey, we're super excited you're here. On today's episode, we interview Dr. Joe Schwartz, the director of McGill University's Office for Science and Society. He's an expert in separating sense from nonsense, the host of the Dr. Joe Show, and is world-renowned for teaching chemistry. We hope you enjoy.
Hi, and welcome back to Let's Talk Chemistry, a science podcast by ChemTalk. I'm one of your co-hosts, Jasmine.
And I'm John. Today, we have a very talented individual to share with you, Dr. Joe Schwartz. Some people may know Dr. Schwartz from his radio show or his various books, but others know him as a professor.
Joe Schwartz is a professor of chemistry at McGill University in Montreal, but really holds many more roles, as John just mentioned. In fact, it would be best to hear from Dr. Schwartz himself.
I'm at McGill University in Montreal, which is one of the top-ranked universities in the world. Professor of chemistry, but I also have another hat, pretty big hat, in the sense that I direct our university's Office for Science and Society, which has a mandate of separating fact from myth and sense from nonsense, which of course these days is quite a challenging enterprise. Besides that, I also have a radio show that I've been doing now for 44 years, said to be the longest radio show on chemistry in the history of the world. I've written 19 books. I do regular newspaper column, do a lot of public lectures. I teach the highest enrollment course in Canadian history. I teach a course on drugs and on food in alternate semesters, each of which have about 2,700 students. So that's in a nutshell what I do. The thread that ties all of this together really is chemistry, which I think is the basic science that indeed is the tie between all the other sciences. Because if you have a feel for what molecules are all about and what they can and cannot do, you have a pretty good feel for what is reasonable and what is not and what can happen and cannot. So, you know, the thrust of our office is to spread good, sound scientific information. As I said, separate sense from nonsense. Make sure that people are up to date on what is happening in the world of science. We try to foster critical thinking and keep people out of the clutches of charlatans.
Just as Dr. Schwartz mentioned, much of his work's focus stems from the university's mission of separating sense from nonsense. In the simplest terms, this means separating fact from myth, particularly in the field of science. It's easy to see, from an example, how important this mission is.
Exactly. Dr. Schwartz shares some current events that have required the use of separating sense from nonsense. One such example is COVID-19, a pandemic that has affected countless individuals globally.
Of all the topics and concerns surrounding COVID-19, one stands out the most: vaccines. Dr. Schwartz shares his thoughts regarding this discussion.
It's the constant battle against the anti-vaxxers. I mean, some of them are philosophically opposed. And that's some, you know, what can you say? If someone says, you know, my religion doesn't permit me, it's very hard to argue against that because, you know, when you're talking religion, you're talking faith, you're not talking science. Of course, even to those people, I try to explain that if you are really a follower of major religion, all religions put health above anything else. And, you know, to protect yourself and to protect others from disease is part and parcel of religion. So there should be no dichotomy there. There are the others who try to claim that vaccines are dangerous on scientific grounds. As I already mentioned, you know, one of the classic things is that they interfere with your DNA, which is just not so. The messenger RNA that is used in vaccines goes into the cytoplasm of the cell. It doesn't go into the nucleus of the cell. So it doesn't interfere with your DNA. And then, you know, they also argue that the vaccine is really not effective. But there have been dozens and dozens of well-controlled studies that show the efficacy. Now, admittedly, the vaccines are not quite as good as we thought they would be when they were first released. Because, of course, the original studies based upon that they got approval are done on a relatively small number of people. Now, most, you know, in your phase 3 studies, you're looking at about 3,000 people. when you're dealing with the population at large, you see some problems that crop up you didn't see in your smaller studies. I mean, you know, if you have a complication rate of 1 in 10,000, you're not going to see that in your preliminary studies, but you'll see it when millions of people are exposed. But that's just the way science works. You cannot predict everything that can happen. You try to have good educated guesses. So it is also a mistake, you know, from the scientific side to minimize the chance that there could be some problem. It's always the question of, do the benefits outweigh the risks? And there's no question, when we look at the number of people who end up in ICUs, who end up in emergency rooms, and you look at their vaccination status, there's just no question that the vaccines protect you. Now, they may not protect you from getting infected as well as we thought that they would. But what they really do is protect you from having a very serious case so that you don't end up in the ICU. But, you know, this is a situation that we will be dealing with, I think, chances are, forever. Just like we've learned to live and deal with the flu, you get your annual flu shot. I'm afraid that that probably is how this is going to turn out. And you just have to learn that there are some risks in life that you have to just accept. And, you know, science cannot solve every problem. What we do is our best, and hope that whatever intervention we have, the benefits outweigh the risks. And so far, certainly that's what we have seen with, you know, all the COVID interventions, whether it's the vaccine or with Paxlovid, or whether it's the monoclonal antibodies, they all had an impact. And of course, you know, then we also get questions about, well, you know, what about long-term effects? The thing with long-term effect is that you cannot study a long-term effect until a long term has passed, you know? So it's a question that cannot be answered. We'll see when the long-term passes. But what we know is that based on everything that we've seen so far, and based on previous history of other vaccines, there are no long-term effects. Whatever problem you may have shows up very quickly after a vaccine has been administered. We've never seen a situation where, you know, the consequence of a vaccine doesn't appear until, you know, 20 years later.
And while the pandemic and its associated effects and vaccines have recently been of concern to the general public, the field of medicine as a whole has also often come into question. Consider cancer. Per Dr. Schwartz, such supplements as soy have been believed to be a cause of cancer. However, scientific publications have proven the link to be non-existent.
Speaking of publications, Dr. Schwartz shared the importance of fact-checking. As we explored during a previous podcast episode completed with Dr. Stephen Clark, it is always important to check your sources when exploring new scientific findings.
Definitely important. Dr. Schwartz shares what he has learned in his separation of sense from nonsense.
So I wish I could tell you that there's one simple formula for fighting pseudoscience. There isn't. The best bet is to hopefully foster critical thinking from early on in schooling, to make students understand how in the scientific world, we know what we know, or at least we think we know, and that it all comes not from just hearsay, but it comes from scrutinizing the scientific literature and knowing what peer review is all about, knowing which journals are more reliable, knowing, you know, which researchers are more reliable, looking for the number of studies that back up any kind of point of view. Because these days, with all of the stuff that is being published, you know, there's 5 or 6 research papers being published every single minute of every day. Not all publications, of course, are of equal value, and you can find some so-called scientific paper to back up almost any view that you may have. So it's important to try to get people to understand how scientific research works, how a researcher will carry out a study, write it up, send it into a journal, the journal's editor sends it out to referees, then there's a lot of back and forth before something gets published. And there's a big difference if something gets published in New England Journal of Medicine or the Indian Journal of Homeopathy. You know, so this is the kind of stuff that we try to get across people, how we know what we think we know in the world of science and why they should be listening to us rather than all of the dedicated misinformants out there.
And I can't help but agree. The process of fact-checking is tedious, but it is very important. In fact, as previously mentioned, many of Dr. Schwartz's works are concerned with debunking myths.
We examine everything in the realm of science. I mean, not only COVID business. We deal a lot with food additives, cosmetics, medications, essentially issues that are of concern to the public, because everyone, especially food, everyone eats. That's one thing that we all have in common. And people get all concerned about what they eat, what they should eat, and what they should not eat. There's a lot of conflicting information out there. We deal a lot with that. A lot about, you know, medications, painkillers, whole OxyContin story. We also deal with some environmental concerns, climate change, deal with genetic modification, biotechnology. So all the kind of issues that are in the news virtually on a daily basis, which have some connection to science and which are also controversial to some degree. So the basic thrust of our office and my staff is to make sure that people interpret what they read in the right way. They know who to listen to, who not to listen to. So really our interest is very broad in scope, because virtually every day something comes up in everyday science, you know, to some extent is controversial. So we try to make sure that we have a good shot at removing the controversy and seeing where the cards fall.
Unfortunately, as Dr. Schwartz mentioned, separating sense from nonsense requires the willingness to dip into the realm of controversy. Yet, this process proves rewarding, especially when we are able to share what we find with others.
Yes, so much of what I love about the field of science is not so much just the learning process, but also the privilege of sharing what I learn with fellow peers and mentees. Dr. Schwartz emphasizes this as well.
I mean, what are we really doing in the world of science? We're working for the betterment of mankind. We're working for the public, right? It's not a question of increasing your own intellectual, you know, capabilities. I mean, there's a reason that we do everything. I mean, sometimes it may not be immediately evident in terms of it being goal-oriented. I mean, there's a lot of fundamental research that is done, hoping that it will eventually lead somewhere. But nevertheless, you need to be able to explain to people why you're doing what you're doing. If you can't explain it, you shouldn't be doing it. You know, this is like professional science is not a hobby. It's something that has a purpose. Whatever your area of research is, there is a goal at the end that somehow should benefit the public. You need to be explained what that goal is. Now, sometimes, you know, that light at the end of the tunnel may be quite far away, but nevertheless, you need to be able to explain what it is, what your goal is, and where you are heading. The purpose of getting research grants, you know, and spending all this money on doing research is hopefully to somehow find something that will improve the lot of mankind.
And such a fun way to communicate is through literature. Dr. Schwartz gave us the following overview of his books.
Some of them are dedicated to food specifically. For example, I did one on Apple a Day. You know, as you can imagine by the title, everything in there deals with food. As a general rule, the books follow the same kind of format. They are composed of relatively short chapters of, you know, 1,000 to 2,000 words each. Because what I found is these days people have relatively short attention spans. A lot of this is because of our, you know, reliance on computer technology and our cell phones, TikTok, and people are used to, you know, 30 seconds or 60 seconds of information. Now, of course, in science, that's not adequate enough. But I think in 1,000 to 2,000 words, you can do justice to just about any issue. You can make it readable and informative without trivializing the science. So that's basically the theme that I followed in all of the books. And they all have a large variety of types of topics. So, you know, all of them have some environmental things, some medical things, some food-oriented issues. And you know, what I hope to do is not only to separate the fact from the myth, which is, you know, basic notion, but also to show people how interesting and widespread science is, that you can, you know, you look into every little nook of your life and you will find something that is scientific and is of interest.
With such a successful catalog to his name, we were curious if any of his books particularly stood out as his favorite, and he obliged our curiosity with an anecdote of his first publication process.
That's like asking whether or not you like one of your children better than the others, to which there's always actually an answer, but it's never an answer that you talk about. No, I really can't say. Well, I'll tell you one interesting story. Is the very first book that I wrote, it came about actually when I was approached by a publisher because they had heard me on radio, seen me on TV, and they wondered if I would be interested in writing a book. And I said, yeah, because actually I've thought about that. And I've always had a problem with the misconceptions about chemistry and chemicals, that people think that the word chemical is synonymous with poison or toxin. So I said, look, I have an idea. I would like to talk about chemicals and talk about risk benefit. And I want to call that book The Right Chemistry. I thought that sounded pretty good. And the publisher said, okay, you know, sounds pretty good. So yeah, I did put together the book and sent it in. And it was, you know, they had the manuscript. And I get a call from the publisher one night. And he says, you know, we just had a meeting with our salespeople. And they've read your book and they really like the book. He said, but you can't call it The Right Chemistry. I said, what are you talking about? He said that you call it that, I'm going to sell it. It's going to end up in some remote science section in the bookstore. People are too scared of chemicals and of chemistry. It's not going to work.
Despite Dr. Schwartz's book being well-received and well-reviewed by the publishing firm, it's interesting to learn that its success was contingent on its title. It really highlights the foresight and creativity that the author and publishers need to produce a successful product.
It's an aspect of the industry that may otherwise go unnoticed if not for people like Dr. Schwartz sharing their experiences. Luckily for him and fans of chemistry, his story had a happy ending.
So I argued a little bit, but said, look, you know, I guess you know more about marketing books than I do. So what do you want? Said, well, you know, we looked through the chapters in your book and we found one that had a title that was intriguing, and we thought we'd just use that title for the whole book. And that title was Radar Hula Hoops and Pig Balls. And it was a story about polyethylene. Polyethylene is a plastic, which initially made radar possible because it was used as insulation around radar cables. After the Second World War, there was a lot of polyethylene left over from all of those processes. And one entrepreneur had the idea of making hula hoops out of polyethylene. So that was that connection. And then the pig balls. Well, it turns out that when pigs are raised in close captivity, which is always the case, they tend to nibble on each other's ears and on each other's tails, which is a problem because they can get infections. And also the ears and the tails have commercial value. They're sold, so they can't be destroyed. And farmers found that they could distract their pigs from nibbling on each other by throwing balls made of polyethylene, which they called pig balls, into the pig pens. The pigs would then happily roll around the ball, then they would leave each other alone. So that's why I called that chapter Radar Hula Hoops and Pig Balls. And that's what they suggested for the title of the book. So I said, well, I don't know. I don't want to be known as Mr. Pig Ball. So I said, I suggest the change here. Those pigs are actually playful. So how about radar, hula hoops, and playful pigs. So that was it. They bought that idea. And we got a nice graphic for the cover of the book. And indeed, it worked. It sold well. But I still had this idea that I want to kind of upgrade the image of chemistry. I still wanted to have a book called Right Chemistry. So I said, when they approached me to the second book, okay, how about now we go with the Right Chemistry? Says, no. I think we need to have a more captivating topic. So the second one was The Genie in the Bottle. And a chapter in there about hydrogen peroxide, which is used to make steam, and you can use it in special effects to make it look like a genie is coming out of the bottle. It's an interesting story. So we went with that.
Who knew hula hoops would have had a connection to World War II? Information like this is great because it goes beyond just being interesting and shows you the effect chemistry can have on any given aspect of our lives.
Absolutely. And to Dr. Schwartz's point, it makes what could seem like a daunting and complicated topic a bit more digestible to a broader audience. But despite the success of the first book and of the subsequent titles that followed, Dr. Schwartz was still intent on upgrading the image of chemistry and published his original title idea as a means to do so. Eventually, he got his wish. Let's hear from him on what the result was.
And I still kept, badgering away to have the next book called The Right Chemistry. And finally, I think by the sixth book, they agreed. The others had sold pretty well. I said, all right, we'll give that a try. So I did. The sixth one was called The Right Chemistry. And, I wish I could tell you that by that time I had set the stage and that people had learned for all of my other books. And I would have loved to say that, The Right Chemistry sold better than all the others, but it didn't. It didn't. People were still, I guess, frightened by seeing the word chemistry in the title, thinking that this would be too difficult for them to, understand that. But nevertheless, I did get my way. I did have a book that's called The Right Chemistry. But after that, we went back to, other titles that were, I think, pretty good and, intriguing, That's the Way the Cookie Crumbles was one. Then 2 years ago, when COVID was rampant, came out with a book, Science Goes Viral, which I think was, pretty good play on words. So, that was sort of an interesting story of, how it all got started and how you have to think about what you're going to call a book. Because after all, there's no point in writing a book if people aren't going to read it.
Despite the obstacles, Dr. Schwartz was able to gain a following as an author. One of the factors that led to the success and popularity of his books, he acknowledged, was the fan base that he had accumulated through his radio career, noting that publicity is a key ingredient to selling your product.
And with the emergence of ebooks, his publicity could extend even further. Whether it's students downloading textbooks or a casual reader listening in their car, the world of audiobooks has transformed the way people consume content. For Dr. Schwartz and other authors alike, this increase in accessibility has allowed for a broader range of demographics to be reached.
However, alongside the benefits of increased technology comes a set of challenges as well. There is one concern that Dr. Schwartz expresses regarding the ubiquity of technology, particularly at the collegiate level.
Of course, we try to hit all ages with, or trying to interest people in science. And it's pretty difficult at your age, because you've grown up with this TikTok, Instagram, Facebook, which basically is very short exposure to different topics, right? Like those TikTok videos are just, a couple of minutes. And you get so used to that, that you expect everything to be in such little sound bites. But in science, we can't do that. You can't make something meaningful really in 1 minute, because the issues generally are too complex. So it is challenging to try to hit a target of exactly your age group.
To an extent, we've become reliant or even dependent on our technology. But the deeper implication of this attachment is the abandonment of the ability to sustain focus. Dr. Schwartz brings an important point to light in that we deviate from the capacity for drawn-out critical thought processes with constant, repeated exposure to short doses of media. This can have an adverse effect on our approach to science, as the scientific method requires patience and regular evaluation.
Embracing the complexity of science and welcoming its challenges is a more productive mindset than expecting the answers in such a brief manner. As compelling as the scientific process may be, there must be some level of balance amidst the busy life of a scientist. For someone as active as Dr. Schwartz, he abides by the following principles.
You try to, you know, partition your time properly. And I mean, you don't take on more than what you can chew. What can I tell you? I mean, you know, 10, 12 working hours in a day, which is what I normally do. You just have to use your time, you know, appropriately. And also realize that if something doesn't get done, you know, if you don't post some video 1 week, the world doesn't come to an end.
Among his several areas of work, Dr. Schwartz does engage in some video media content and had some follow-up comments about his previous point. Have a listen.
Try to do two short videos every week, sort of the TikTok format. I mean, I don't want to totally negate the, you know, short stuff, because if you take one very little specific topic, you can do something in a few minutes. You just can't cover some much larger topic, which generally is the more interesting thing. But you can do a little bit of tidbit stuff to tickle someone's imagination. And I do have videos, you know, I do short videos every week. I think they do serve a purpose. You don't get millions of hits. I mean, you know, and this is always the concerning thing. I mean, I look at some of the really stupid stuff that you see on TikTok, and they get millions of hits. Whereas if you try to do something good science and try to make it entertaining, I mean, you know, hundreds, maybe a few thousand hits. But it's the really weird, you know, stuff that get hits on TikTok. When you consider that you have these videos with these, what do we call them, the Kinder eggs, you know, at the eggs, they open up and there's some prize and there's something in there. And the video of a kid opening up these things and has millions of views, you know, and I do some clever science video and it gets 500 views. So it's a crazy world.
I love Dr. Schwartz's point here, and he identifies an interesting observation about what we seem to value as a society. The time spent consuming mindless material seems to be disproportionate to the time spent engaging in these challenging concepts. And not that there isn't a time or place for both, but the scale appears to be tipped. Hopefully, Dr. Schwartz and others are able to help push the culture to engage our minds in more meaningful ways.
For as large of a presence as he has in the scientific community, he certainly has the means to continue providing us with invaluable education. But not just through books and lab work. He's also been on a television program.
Indeed, he has. It was featured on the Discovery Channel. Here's Dr. Schwartz reflecting on his time making the show.
It was called Science to Go, which was all based on food. So each week we would look at some specific food. So we'd look at pizza one another week. So it was fun to do. But one season of that was enough. It's a lot of work. People don't realize, you know, how much work it is to do something like that. People think that, you know, you have a half hour TV show, thing that takes half hour to just record that. It doesn't. It takes hours and hours and hours, you know, and you script it and it's back and forth and you hum a little bit and you have to redo that. It's just to do very good TV is just a lot of work.
And as if television, radio, and video content weren't enough, Dr. Schwartz is a professor on top of it all. Part of being a teacher is making the material as appealing and digestible as possible, and Dr. Schwartz shared his thoughts on how to do just that.
You have to use examples which they can relate to, which play some role in their life. And especially in what I teach, either organic chemistry or pharmaceutical chemistry or nutritional science, it's very easy to do that because there are all kinds of everyday examples. And of course, it doesn't mean that you have to trivialize the hard science that you teach. I mean, you still, you know, have to go in depth. The students have to understand why you are doing that. So, I mean, just to you know, pick an example, when you're teaching polymer science and you're talking about various kinds of, you know, polymerization reactions and how you initiate a reaction and what catalyst you use and what the mechanism of the reaction is, which I think, you know, what is important to know. But you also have to always make sure that they know why it is important to know and what the end goal is and what is the role of that polymer that you're talking about. Where is it useful? And that to me is really what has proven to be successful, is always have practical examples in your lectures so they understand why they have to learn what they have to learn.
Personally, I can think of several occasions, especially in the classroom and at different jobs, where I could not connect with the work or the concepts because I just couldn't relate to them. I couldn't find the point, purpose, or meaning behind what we were doing, and it really quelled my interest and motivation. On the other hand, when you draw a direct line between practical, everyday examples and the subject, things suddenly become much more palatable.
People don't like having their time wasted. Part of addressing that is, like Dr. Schwartz shared, giving practical examples to help people relate more to the material, as well as to give a why behind what you're learning, especially the more difficult topics. Dr. Schwartz had a personal experience of his own that actually sparked his drive to make education more meaningful, which he shares here.
I had a very early lesson in that from my own undergrad career, which goes back, I don't even want to tell you how far it goes back. But I had a second year PhysChem course. And physical chemistry tends to be, you know, traditionally one of the more difficult university courses. You have to learn all kinds of equations and, you know, complex processes and all of that. And I learned it. In fact, you know, I did very well in the course. And then somewhere near the end, when we were talking about all kinds of electrochemical reactions and we had done all kinds of calculations, somehow the prof just blurted out that what we were talking about here was the design of a battery. Now, if he had just said that at the beginning, when he said, well, here's what we're going to do. We are going to take a look at the science of batteries and how they work and how they are constructed. And this is why you have to do what we're going to do here, all of the complex chemistry. It would have been all much more palatable. Because frankly, when we were just doing this PhysChem all blind, it was, what can I tell you, like trying to learn a different language, you know, which you can do, but we weren't seeing what the point of it was. And that's when, you know, I kind of back then decided that if I ever had the chance of going into academia, and I had always planned on that, I always liked the idea of transmitting information, and that I would never do it like that. I would always make sure that they knew why they were doing something. You know, if you had to learn about amino acids and glutamic acid, well, you would tell them about monosodium glutamate and so-called, you know, Chinese restaurant syndrome, which actually is a terrible misnomer. But then you can discuss why that's a misnomer and discuss why monosodium glutamate is put into food and why there's controversy. You're talking about making peptides or, you know, amino acid dimers. You bring in aspartame, which is the artificial sweetener that is so commonly used. When you discuss the chemistry of how this is made, which of course is important to know, but then it also allows you to discuss the sociological connections. Why are people so dependent on artificial sweeteners? What are the risks and benefits there? Should you listen to the people who tell you that if you're using artificial sweetener, if you're drinking Diet Coke, you're poisoning yourself? Is there any truth to that? And, you know, as soon as you bring in examples like that, then the students are much more willing to learn the science behind it because they see the purpose. So that really is, I think, what has resulted in whatever success that I've had is the idea of making the courses relevant. But that takes thinking about it. You know, when you put together a lecture, you got to think about this. Okay, I want to teach this concept. What example can I use that will make this more attention grabbing, more interesting, make them want to learn this? You know, and especially in chemistry, where it's so easy to do that because it, you know, this is not like calculus. I mean, one can argue that, you know, you need to learn calculus because it is an intellectual exercise. It teaches you thinking. It, you know, it teaches you how to manipulate numbers and teaches you a certain degree of logic. But the average person is never going to get to use calculus in your everyday life, right? But everyone uses chemistry in your everyday life. Whether you're putting on a cosmetic or whether you're using toothpaste or whether you're taking a medication or you're dyeing your hair or permanenting your hair or putting on your nail polish. I mean, all of these are chemical processes and there's very interesting chemistry behind them. But that interesting chemistry becomes much more palatable to learn if you see why you're doing that. So that's really what my emphasis has been in my teaching. But I think, you know, I also, you know, I want to emphasize that just by, you know, bringing in the everyday examples doesn't mean that you trivialize the hard science. I mean, you still have to learn how things work and reaction mechanisms and that, but it all becomes much more acceptable when you see the end goal.
As I was listening to Dr. Schwartz talking about his approach to teaching, it reminded me of a TED Talk I had heard by a gentleman named Simon Sinek. It's pretty famous by now, but in the talk he discussed finding your why and how identifying your purpose drives your motivation and actions. It's a slightly different context, but the concept is the same as Dr. Schwartz's point. It may ultimately be up to the individual, but people in positions of leadership, like teachers, can help to encourage, motivate, and assist their students by emphasizing the why.
And it can certainly help navigate the hard material rather than shortcutting it, like Dr. Schwartz said. He's given us so much incredible insight throughout this episode, and it's only fitting that we conclude with some advice that he had to give. Whether it's making academia more relatable or publishing informative books, Dr. Schwartz strives to make science accessible, meaningful, and enjoyable through all mediums.
Well, writing books, this is a challenging thing, especially these days. I don't know what the most recent statistics are, that 9 out of every 10 books that are published lose money. That's, you know, that's a frightening statistic. That's unfortunately how the book world works, because people are just so accustomed to doing things online now. But if someone is dedicated, it still can be done. But writing a book is challenging. I mean, you know, unless you're a John Grisham or, you know, a Michener or, you know, some Stephen King, chance of making it big in publishing is not great. You generally don't start out by saying, you know, I'm going to write a book. You have to have a career that somehow may lead to that down the line. For students your age, my advice is to do what you like to do. Because if you enjoy what you're studying, it eventually is going to lead somewhere. So it's very important to make a choice in your academic career that is based on your interests, not on what your parents may want you to do or what you think is the best career goal. What you have to think about is what you are interested in and what you can see yourself doing in your life. But I also have to add to that, that the chance that that's where you're going to end up is very small. That's just not how life works. People don't end up where they think they're going to end up. Usually you end up taking some tangent and you never can predict what that is going to be. When you engage in something that you like to do that interests you, something will happen. No. So choosing a path is difficult, a career path, but don't choose something because someone else tells you to do it. You look around and you see what interests you.
A big thank you to Dr. Schwartz for being so generous with his time and his knowledge. And thanks to you for listening. We hope you took away something informative, fun, and inspiring. Until next time, bye for now.
Thank you for listening to Let's Talk Chemistry, a podcast by ChemTalk. We hope you enjoyed it. For more information on today's episode and countless chemistry resources, please visit our website at www.chemistrytalk.org.